So welcome everybody here. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Florin Diacu, the UVic site director of PIMS. And I'm very happy to introduce now Professor Donald Sari from the University of California at Irvine. Well, I must confess that last night I started searching the web, so I typed Donald Sari. Of course, I want to search the web to make this introduction. And after I did that, after I typed Donald Sari, I got 10,100 entries. Well, I said probably it's a good idea to refine my search. Otherwise, I would give a talk today. And that's what I did. And I typed Donald G. Sari, and still I got about 7,000 entries. And then I decided, okay, let's do an advanced search such that I get Donald G. Sari together in one sequence. And then I still got 732 entries. So then I thought it would be better to not to look at those things, since I already knew some of them, and to tell what I know about Don. And I know already a lot. So what I'm going to tell you is just a few things now. So Don obtained his PhD from Purdue University under the supervision of Harry Pollard, and wrote a very nice thesis in celestial mechanics. After that, he had a one-year position at Yale, and after that was hired by Northwestern University, where his career developed very well. He was the first Gladys and Penko chair of mathematics and professor of economics at Northwestern University, and then he received recently a chaired position at the University of California at Irvine, where he's also the director of a research institute. Now, Don has many preoccupations, mathematical preoccupations, so he started with celestial mechanics, and also is doing a lot of work in the dynamical aspects of economics, social sciences, and psychology. Has published many papers, several books, is a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and also the chief editor of the Bulletin of the American Mathematical Society. Besides that, he's a very good speaker, and we had the opportunity to have him twice here in Victoria. So I'm very glad to welcome him again, and I would like to ask him to talk about, to give us his first out of a series of five talks. Thank you, Don.
Thank you. What a kind introduction. I thank you very much for that. And I'm also glad you didn't read those web pages, because you might not have had such a kind introduction if you saw some of the other things on there. What I want to talk about today, it's a delight being here. You see my background, my connections with this university, with this department, actually go back quite a long way. Some of you remember Marv Shinbrot. And when Marv Shinbrot was here, Marv came back to Northwestern University, and he tried to recruit me. And I just kept thinking about Victoria, British Columbia. I said, yeah. But for family reasons, we didn't come. So who knows? I might, if it hadn't been for that, I might be a colleague up here. So it's always nice to be back. And today, I'm going to start a series of lectures, really under the general title, Mathematical Social Sciences. An oxymoron? Well, most mathematicians would say absolutely. I know I did for a long time. In fact, at one time, I even believed that social sciences was an oxymoron. But what happens is that I've discovered that no, that's not the case. That what happens is in the last 20, 30 years, the mathematical social sciences have become mathematically more sophisticated. 30 years ago? Yes. Today? No. And there's some interesting things going on. And what I want to do is I want to show you some of the interesting things that are going on, giving you an overview. Hopefully, I might even get some of you interested in looking at these topics. Now, why would you want to look at some of the questions from the mathematical social sciences? For the same reason mathematicians always look at problems. Fascinating, difficult, challenging, and meaningful. And boy, they satisfy all of them. Now, let me give you an example. Here's one. To find problems that are different. See, the question is that they're very different. It's not more of mathematical physics or mathematical biology or any of the other mathematics. Let me give you a problem. Ask you if you can solve this one. Here's one. Find all possible. Find all F, G, and H with the weakest possible smoothness conditions, which satisfy this functional equation. Willing to bet you haven't seen a functional equation like that one before. We've seen a lot of functional equations in mathematics, but not like that one right there. It is known when these are sufficiently smooth what the answer is, and I don't recall what it is offhand now, but it is known. Now, we're in a world with such an ugly-looking equation or difficult-looking equation like this crop up from psychology experiments. In psychology, they just have the people, they ask questions of the students and everything like this, and they find their reactions, and they find that there is certain laws that have to satisfy a functional relationship of this type right here. And the question is that what is the law? So it's not almost, this is a precise expression that has to be satisfied. Duncan Luce wrote a little about this equation and others in his, about Janos Axel, who's at Waterloo, I believe it is, and, here in Canada, Personal Reflections of an Unintentional Behavioral Scientist. Now, I'm talking about the social sciences, but boy, are they different than the physical sciences. I know that because I've worked in both. So, if I can figure out how to get this paper open, there we go. Let me give you really the differences, as I see it, between the physical sciences and social sciences. Are there any social scientists in here? Good. What I'm going to ask you here is that the difference when you're doing not the social sciences, but the mathematical social sciences, or mathematical physical sciences, is there is a de facto division of labor. It is the physicist who, for the most part, design the models. And it is the mathematicians, for the most part, who use these mathematical models to discover the mathematical properties of their behavior. All right? And in fact, what we've had is a couple of millennia of the physicists, of people in physical sciences and the mathematical sciences working back and forth. And so there's this strong symbiotic relationship between mathematics. A lot of mathematics is governed by the issues that have been raised in the social physical sciences, and a lot of the physical developments are caused by what mathematics we can do. But this is not the same in the social sciences. The social sciences, and when we talk in terms of mathematical social sciences, we're really talking about the last 20, 30 years. Am I right on that? About the last 20... For the sophistication, it goes back to Adam Smith. Adam Smith read Isaac Newton and tried to take the same ideas that he did and rewrote his book, etc. But the fact is, as far as the mathematical sophistication of the social sciences, maybe it's about the last 10, 15 years or something like that. So this means that when you work in the social sciences, mathematical social sciences, you got to look at it in a different way. We have to change the way we think. Social sciences, creating the models. My firm belief is that's strictly the role of the social scientists. Mathematicians, stay away. I have seen some models created by mathematicians. And for the most part, they have, thankfully, faded into oblivion. Okay? No one remembers them. The reason is we just plain don't have the instinct, the intuition, to create the models. Discovering of the mathematical properties of their behavior, that will eventually will be the role of the mathematicians. Not now. There aren't enough of them. But eventually, the mathematicians will be playing a strong role. But there is a second issue. What are the basic issues? What are the basic concerns that are going on? And this is where the social sciences differ from the physical sciences. A physical scientist comes in and he will know exactly, if you tell him your area, kind of exactly what you can do and what to ask of you. A social scientist, if you come and talk to me, you have no idea what I'm capable of doing. So you ask what you might think I can do, not what might, what could be done. So this is where there's some exciting areas. How do we identify the basic issues, the basic concerns in the social sciences? And that's what I'm going to show today. I'm going to show you some of these things. To do so, and I apologize for one or two of you who have seen this one example before. It's my favorite. I don't know if you know this, but when they were planning the little tea and or whatever it is right after here, what they really did is there's 15 people on the planning committee. Okay, mathematicians need big committees. And what happens is they were trying to decide what beverage should we offer you. Six people said they want milk. If milk's not available, wine and then beer. Five people said beer. Or wine and beer. And four people, they just came back from California. And they want wine. Okay. Wine, beer, or milk. And so what do? Is we vote. I mean, democratic. Milk gets 6 votes. Beer gets 5 votes. Wine gets 4 votes. And that's why we're going to have milk when we gather after my talk. But let's take a look. Suppose in planning, what happened actually is they went down to the beverage store and they said they wanted to buy a keg of milk. And they said, good thing you didn't want to have beer, because what we had is a bunch of statisticians in here. And they just wiped us out of beer. So if we're talking about milk versus wine, it's clear we're going to choose milk, isn't it? That's obvious. I mean, milk's in first place, wine's in last. Let's take a look. Milk gets 6. Wine gets 5. Wine gets 4. And what we end up with is really the people by a 60% margin. They really prefer wine to milk. They really prefer last place wine to first place milk. Let's take a look at milk versus beer. Milk gets 6 votes. Beer gets 5 votes. Beer gets 4 votes. These people really prefer anything to milk. Rightfully so. All right. And now if they're comparing beer and wine, what do you have is you have wine gets 6 votes. Beer gets 5 votes. Wine gets 4 votes. And so wine comes in last place, but in fact it turns out that these people prefer wine to anything. If you want beer, no problem. If you want beer, I'll give you an election procedure. Have a runoff. If we have a runoff, well, what's going to happen is we're going to drop wine, right? Okay, we're going to drop wine right here. And if we drop wine, the runoff's between milk and beer wins. And so what we have is, this is like walking out of the men's room with a piece of paper stuck on your, on your feet. So what you do is you get beer. So if we have the usual election procedure, we're going to have milk. If we have a pairwise comparison, we're going to have wine. And if we have a runoff, we're going to have beer. Nobody's opinion changed. Nobody's opinion changed. They all remain the same. And yet what we did is we got three different answers, showing that the election outcome may more accurately reflect what procedure you used rather than what the people wanted. Who won your last election in your department? Who really should have won? So what happens then is this is a true concern. All righty. Let me ask social scientists, what's your reaction to this? How about you? What's your reaction to this? Oh, all right, I'll show you that later on, why it doesn't mean what Arrow's theorem doesn't mean what Arrow said it did. Okay. Huh? Condorcet, okay. But then you both know a little bit about voting theory. Usually when you talk to a social scientist on these type of things, they say, well, that's troubling, but I'm not so sure it really matters. And besides, we create institutions and da-da-da-da-da. Okay? And this is the standard type argument they have. This is what I mean, is that when you're looking for problems in the social science, you really have to try to guess what is it that the social scientist would really like to have done if they knew it could be done. And what is it a mathematician is going to do? A mathematician is going to say, hey, I have a mapping here. An election procedure is just a mapping. And I have a mapping coming from my individual preferences to election orderings. And the mathematician is going to ask a couple of different questions. Well, what do I have? Is I have actually three mappings. I have a mapping which is equal to four mappings. The pairwise mappings. I have the runoff mapping. And I have the plurality mapping. And I get different outcomes from the same input. The mathematician wants to find out what's the total image space of a mapping, right? You got a mapping? What's its image? What's its domain? What are the properties of the domain? Are these, so let's change them. Are these probability, are these paradoxes isolated? Or are they abundant in terms of measure, in terms of something else? Are these what else can happen? All right? And so by taking the questions which we have and changing the framework, what we end up with then is a large number of questions that mathematically are possible to attack. Let me show you. What else can happen? Well, for what else can happen, I don't know if you saw, but I drove up in a real nice, they rented for me a real nice red car. And I decided that I'm going to auction it off. I got a little game for you to play. What happens in my little red car is your game is the following. All you have to do is you go out there and you choose. I got a bowl and you choose and you reach inside that bowl. And if you get a red marble, that car is yours. You get a blue one, the car is mine, but you got to pay for it. But I'm going to give you some information. I've got earn one and earn two. And I'm going to give you information. I'm going to tell you there's a higher fraction of reds in earn one than in earn two. So which earn do you want to choose?
Higher fraction in earn one?
Yeah, higher fraction of reds in earn one.
I'll still have co. Because if I'm... Am I forced to choose one?
You got to choose only one urn and then reach in blindly.
Can
reach
I not choose?
Oh, no, no, no. You got to play my game. Which urn would you choose? Which one's got more reds, higher fraction of reds than this one right here? Which one are you going to choose? One with the higher fractions, right? Yeah, okay. Sounds right. And over here, see, he's already cautious. Red, 1', red, 2'. A higher fraction of reds here, and so we're going to do the same thing, right? Either one you see, if I come with this set of urns, if I come with that set of urns, you're going to choose. All right. Now I'm going to take all of these good urns and put them all in here. Okay. And now I'm going to take all of the bad ones and put them in here. Which one do you want?
This one's still going to earn one.
You earn one, sure. Two goods don't make are always going to be better than two bads. I mean, let's just get some numbers to find out. Suppose I have 2 out of 6 in here. And now I have 24 in here. So let's see, that's 1/3, 8. So I better put one more in here. There's 9. Okay. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to have 3 out of 6 here. Half of them are red. And I'm going to have 24. Let's see, that's half. So let's take down 11. Okay. So what happens is this number is larger than this. And this fraction is larger than this one right here. And you already see what's going to happen, don't you? And now I'm going to have 30 marbles when I put them all together in both urns. And I'm going to have 9 plus 3 is 12, and 11 plus 2 is 13. This is, in other words, what happens is selection orderings and almost all the social sciences are aggregation procedures. They're aggregation procedures. We're aggregating what people want in economics. We're aggregating all sorts of things. So we have to expect the same type of phenomena to crop up in statistics, probability, and all these others. So really the problems I'm talking about today are, I'm going to talk about voting, but all of the results extend to probability, to statistics, and all the other areas. Okay? And where does this crop up? This urn problem crops up, actually it cropped up in the California schools. In the California school system, what they do is they have the academic performance index. And what they're going to do is that reach each group, what they're going to do is they're going to say that the schools have to improve. You take what happens is the whites, and what they have to do is we look at their performance 1 year, and we look at their performance the next year. And they have to improve. And then we look at the Latinos, and they have to improve. And the school has to improve. Well, what happened is in California, at a local school, the white group, here's last year's performance of those who passed a certain exam, the Stanford exam. What happened is the whites improved from last year to this year. The Latinos improved from last year to this year. And the school did poor from last year to this year as a whole. Because, and this wasn't isolated, it happened to 70 schools across the state. So these are the kind of problems and caused difficulties. So let's go back to the mathematician's problem about elections. I gave you one example, and now I'm going to give you another. One of the difficulties which we have in election procedures is with the plurality vote. Let me go back to the wine and show you what went wrong there, and then I'm going to get the show you. See, look what happens here. Melk came in first place, even though it's arguable that Melk is the worst choice. Milk. Milk was liked by over a third, but almost two-thirds of the people didn't like milk. And that's where the paradox cropped up. Will this paradox crop up in practice? All over the place, folks. We had a big example of this in France. In France, when Le Pen came in second place, everyone said about the society and everything else. It wasn't the society, it was the voting procedure. It's that people could only reflect who's in first place. He had 10 candidates, and so all he needed is one more than one-tenth of the, or slightly over a tenth of the, he had 17% of the populace behind him, and he's going to come in second or first. So clearly what we have to do to avoid these types of problems is to give so many points for first place vote, so many points for second place vote, so many points for a third place vote, etc. In other words, we're going to use that information about what people have lower ranked. Alrighty. If we do, let me give you some examples. The plurality vote is where I give 1 point to my first place and zero to all others. That's the plurality vote. The French mathematician Borda said, well, if I have three candidates, I'll give 2 points to my first place candidate, one to my second, and zero to my third. If I have five candidates, I'll give 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Something which we do, the personnel committee in every department does, is anti-plurality voting. You try to vote against somebody. Let's get rid of those number of people that have applied down to a manageable style. And so that is voting for every, if I vote for 1, 2, 3, 0 for four candidates, I'm really voting against one candidate. Alrighty. So with these weights, we should get more rhyme and reason. We should get more consistency in our election outcomes. Let's see. Suppose we have a department of 10 people on a committee, personnel committee, and what are they going to do? They have to select the one person for tenure track position. Two of them prefer Alice to Barbara to Carol to Diane. One prefers Alice to Carol to Diane to Barbara, etc. You can read it right down here. Suppose you vote for one. If we vote for one, it's clear. Alice gets half the votes. Alice is the winner. So if we vote for one, Alice will get one, and Barbara gets nothing, Carol gets two, Diane gets three. Barbara didn't get a single vote. But if we ask them to vote for two, Barbara is the winner. Take a look. Barbara gets second place here, she gets seven votes. If we vote for three, Carol is the winner. If we vote for can't vote for four, so let's just add these up. If we add these up, I get 0, 1, 2, 3. I get the board of count if I add up all those three procedures. If I vote for, use the board of count, Diane's the winner. No matter who you have, no matter what you can have, is anyone can win. Anyone can win with a simple 10 voter example. So the issue then is, how bad can it get? It's a question that a mathematician's going to ask. How bad can it get? All right? And so in some sense, and I'm not going to go too deeply into how bad it can get or the argument on it. Later, if people are interested, I'll show you exactly how to do these things. But what is it that we have? We have Here is the axis for Alice. Here's the axis for Barbara. Here's the axis for Carol. And here is the fourth dimension, the axis for Diane. You're in a four-dimensional space. And in some sense, what we want to know is, how do all possible election tallies? It turns out that all possible election tallies define a geometric object. Let's see why. Well, the reason it is that if I take any election method, 3, 2, 1, 0. What did I show you? I already showed you that this is equal to 1, 0, 0, 0, plus 1, 1, 0, 0, plus 1, 1, 1, 0, right here. And really what happens then is that any way to put weights inside here is just going to be a linear combination of these three things right here. So the election outcome for these three points right here define three vertices of a triangle. The profile, the listing of election outcomes you have, they define three vertices of a triangle. And what you want to know is you want to find all possible ways you can position that triangle in this space right here, in this four-dimensional space. So there's a geometric problem now. All possible ways you can position that relative to the different rankings that you get to see how many election outcomes can result. Okay? So the answer is that it's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. There are examples, simple examples of voters' preferences with n candidates. So now I'm in an n-dimensional Euclidean space. Where what is the following? Where there is going to be n factorial minus n minus 1 factorial different strict rankings by just changing the procedure. So what does that mean? That means then for three candidates, I can find an example which will have four different strict rankings where the election outcome will change just by changing the procedure. Example? The beverage example is one. Very simple. The beverage example turns out to have that property. It has four different election rankings. As I change the weights, how many points I give for first place, second place, third place candidate. For four candidates, that's going to be 4 factorial minus 3 factorial, 24 minus 6. There's 18. There's examples can be created where you will have 18 different election rankings. 18 different election rankings. Where, just if I give, how many points do I give for a first place candidate, second place candidate, third place candidate, and fourth place candidate, make difference in the outcome. And where is such an example? Right here. A 10 voter example gives you 18 different election outcomes. France, Le Pen. They had 10 candidates. 10 candidates. So, with 10 candidates, it is possible to have as many as 10 factorial minus 9 factorial examples with 10 factorial minus 9 factorial different election rankings. That's about 3 million different outcomes that you can construct a somewhat innocuous looking example of voters' preferences. Whereas you just change how much weight you give your first candidate, your second candidate, your third, etc. Just vary those things. What you will end up with is up to over 3 million different election rankings where each candidate can be is wins and each candidate is bottom ranked with a different procedure. Bothersome. How likelihood is it to get bad things like this happening? Well, if you have three candidates, and very conservative assumptions about voters' preferences, central limit theorem type of conditions, you can get as many as 69%. 69% of the time, you can expect that the election outcome will change when you change the voting procedure. Do I trust election outcomes? Hell no. I don't believe in them anymore at all. We just had one in mathematics, didn't we? Called the Fields Medal. Where, because they couldn't get an election outcome, they selected only two out instead of four people. And it was really because of the decision procedure they used that caused the difficulties. The big controversy. What happens is once you start getting up to a real large number of candidates, like about six candidates, it's something like around 98% of the time you can expect the election outcome to change with the procedure. Ouch. Ouch. These are recent results. And so really, but the point is that these results, they're mine, but these results right here come from taking a mathematician's attitude towards the social sciences. The social scientists pose the problems, what are important. The mathematician says, I'm just talking about a mapping from a domain into a range. And what are the natural questions? Natural question is how big is our bad thing? We know what are good things, so how bad is the point of bad things? And you compute these outcomes. What is the how many bad things can occur? Well, there you just figure out and you use the geometry. And you use the geometric picture and you answer questions which normally you can think would be possible. All of these results, by the way, carry over to statistics. Probability. In statistics, they all carry over to different weights. There are different non-parametric methods. Different non-parametric methods for ranking alternatives. And each and every one of these results carry over to the non-parametric methods in statistics and elsewhere. Well, when you're looking at these things mathematically, what you do is you do the obvious, is you compute the dimension of the domain and you compute the dimension of the outcome and you say, wow, much more can happen because not everything is used up. So the mathematician is then going to ask, well, what happens if we drop a candidate? Remember, with the Beveridge example, we dropped a candidate for the pairwise elections and hell broke loose. So let's try this. Here's an election outcome. It is, how many do I have here? 9 plus 8 is 17, plus 13 is 30 people. When you have the election outcome, A is first place, B is in second place, C is in third place, D is in last place. Count. A gets 9 votes, B gets 8, 7, 6. You're in a hiring committee, you're going to go hire A. But A calls and says, no, I'm going to the Institute for Advanced Studies. So therefore, you got to go to, you're going to hire A. But before you go, D calls and said she's going to the Institute for Advanced Studies. Your last place candidate shouldn't change anything. No department I know would ever have another election. Yet, if D drops out, well, B would get 2 more votes. C would get 4 more votes. And so C was only 2 votes behind. So C would be in first place, B would be in second place, and A would be in last place. The election outcome would flip. Suppose C dropped out, not D. The election outcome would flip. Suppose B would drop out. The election outcome would flip. Suppose A would. It would flip. No matter who drops out, the election outcome would flip. I should have created an example where if 2 people dropped out, it flipped back again. But this one right here, if 2 people drop out, it still stays the opposite. So no matter if anyone drops out, the election outcome flips. So it's consistent with that. So was A the best choice or was D the best choice? think back to your latest election, or to an election outcome where you were saying, oh, I don't know about that outcome. You've all had elections where you'd say, geez, my colleagues. Okay. Why in the world did they do that? Maybe it wasn't your colleagues. Maybe it was your election procedure. In fact, what happens, as it says, is that if we take a set of candidates right here, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and we're going to rank them as A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Now, if a G drops out, how do you want to rank them? Any way you want. Or he wants to rank them opposite. F, E, D, C, B, A. And now, but if it wasn't G that dropped out, F dropped out, how do you want to rank them?
F dropped out?
Yeah.
B, C, D, A.
E, G, something like that. You see what I'm going to do? I can go around and ask each of you to write down a ranking if somebody dropped out. Then if two people dropped out, I would ask each of you to give me a new ranking. I don't care. Use or flip a coin. I don't care. Three dropped out. Give me another new ranking. See how chaotic it can be? And the answer is that for your example, for your choice set here, there exists an example. There exists an example of voter preferences such that that will be the sincere election outcome no matter how they elect. It's worse than a random number generator. It's worse than a random number generator. In fact, remember the result I told you about three-pointers in the election, where I said 69% of the time the outcome can change? The election outcome really is nothing much more than selecting by chance, is what it says. And in fact, if you go through now and you choose the weights you're going to use over here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and the weights you want to use here, and for each of them, you tell me how you want to have them tallied, what weights you're going to use, then the answer is that for almost all choices, this means with exception of algebraic variety, of procedures, of weights. You can create an example which will be as chaotic as you want it to be. Carries over to statistics, non-parametric statistics, that if you drop a candidate, whatever you want just goes to hell. So what's the natural question here? Boy, and not only that, these results are about as likely as you want them to be. I mean, you know, you're running into, with eight candidates, seven candidates, you're running into a 90% or about at least a, you know, pretty high percentage of the time you're going to have bad outcomes. Well over half. So what is the question you want to ask? Well, the first question you want to ask is, how did you prove it? I mean, after all, how many examples can you write down? If you have six candidates, how many examples can you create for ties and everything else? Different examples. When you're dropping candidates and things like this. Well, actually, it is more than 10. Oh, excuse me. You can have more than 10 to the 70th. For six candidates, you can have more than 10 to the 70th examples. And so the question is you're surely not going to do this by a computer simulation. The poor computer, I mean, come on, the poor computer doing 10 to the 12th operations, the real fastest ones we have per second, and the 10 to the 20th seconds since the Big Bang, that's 10 to the 32nd, and if you have a million of them, that's 10 to the 6 more, you still aren't even counting that high. And that's only for six candidates. So the way in which these results were proved really came from the theory of chaos in dynamical systems. In chaos, what is it that we do? In chaos, who here doesn't know what chaos is? Who doesn't know what chaos is but refuses to raise their hand? Who's a liar? Let me tell you, I'm willing to bet there's several in here who don't know what chaos is. So I'll tell you what chaos is. What's the most chaotic thing that's happened to you? For you, personally, what's the most chaotic thing? Not mathematics, chaos. What about you? Well, I think one of the most chaotic things that happened to me were kids. You get up in the morning and, you know, there are about five different things that can occur. And, you know, each one of those are going to cause... You get the two kids get up in the morning and they're sitting down there watching TV. Johnny did this! And you know what's going to happen. And then that's going to happen this. And this is going to cause this to happen. And that's going to cause this to happen. And what happens is you have very quickly an infinite number of different branches, of different events that can happen. High unpredictability. That is essentially what chaos is. And what we do is in mathematics is we just develop tools, mathematical tools, to show we get all these bifurcations. You get a certain type of behavior going along and you get to a certain juncture. And a slight change, what happens? You can jump off in two different directions or many different directions. And then you come to another juncture, and that can... So what you're doing is you have continual bifurcations, continual different junctures cropping up. So by use of the tools, the mathematical tools which were developed for chaos, I said, well, hell, this looks pretty chaotic. Here are the different election outcomes I can have for one set of elections. Here are the different ones I can have if I drop a candidate, the different one I can have here. And by taking the tools of chaos... It now is possible to handle them so you can look at questions of probability, statistics, the social sciences, and then find out all sorts of things, all possible things that can occur. And it turns out that only one procedure minimizes the number of horrible things that can occur. And that's the board account. And the board account has that property strictly because of the nice difference of one between these things right here. Okay? So that's really... Now, as a mathematician, if I had six candidates, and I'm going to list all of the ways you can have... Alrighty. Now it's time to find out why, what goes wrong and why. suppose we have an election between, we have an election, and Florin, you're one of the candidates, and what happens, we'll make you one of the other candidates. How many votes did you get? Yeah, how many votes did you get? You got five. How many did you get?
Four.
Okay. See, I very seldom to get someone. We ask the second one, who's the winner. It's just outright modesty. Okay. So, a way of determining election outcomes is I can take one of the people that voted for him and one that voted for him and pair them together. That's a tie. 1-1. It's a tie. I have four tie votes, and he has one vote left over. He has one vote left over. So because that one vote breaks the tie, and so we say that he's the winner by margin of one. So really, to understand what goes wrong and why, we want to know what are the different ways to get ties. Ways to get ties. Well, here's one. I'm going to really talk about a Z3 orbit. Okay? I'm going to take a wheel, and I'm going to tack that wheel up. And I'm going to then write down A, B, C as the candidate's name. So I got a wheel, and I just went up there, and I just... And then I wrote down the names of the candidates, A, B, and C. All right? So what does this wheel say? This wheel says A is in first place, B is in second place, C is in third place. Okay? Then I'm going to spin the wheel, or turn it, so I get a 1 here, a 2 here, and a 3 here. And what do I have? I have B is in first place, C is in second place, and A is in third place. Spin it one more time. 1, 2, 3. C is in first place, A is in second place, and B is in third place. What do you have? By construction, each candidate is in first place, second place, and third place precisely once. Who's favored? Nobody. There is a tied configuration. A tied configuration. In fact, if you choose any of these procedures, W1, W2, W3, each candidate will get the same election tally. They'll get W1 point when they're in first place, W2 points when they're in second place, and 0 for W3. So this is a situation which should give me a tie. But it doesn't if you have pairwise elections. If you have a pairwise election, what happens? A beats B twice. A beats B twice. AB, AB, BA. So the election outcome is AB, the Condorcet triplet is what I got here. B beats C twice. And C beats A twice. So I have A is better than B, B is better than C, but C is better than A. Why? From a mathematical perspective, we say Z3, which is a group, doesn't have a subgroup of order 2. It's all simple as that. But you mathematically, what you're doing is you're saying that we're losing information. What we're doing is the procedure is losing the information. It doesn't recognize that these things are tied together. So what this tells me is whenever I see a configuration like this right here, the pairwise vote is incapable of understanding that this should be a tie. Hence, it's going to create a paradox. It's going to create a cause of the, it's going to cause the election outcome to be biased. What does this tell me to do? This says, for tie situations, look at orbits of symmetry groups. For if we want to find out what configuration of preferences, yours, 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 and yours, time together and say, when should it be a tie? What we do is we look at all the symmetry groups in Rn, n-dimensional space for n candidates. We look at their orbits. And we say, wow, no reason they shouldn't be tied. And so what you do is you find out what procedures should give you a tie. If they don't give you a tie, then the mathematics says those procedures are throwing in a bias. They're introducing a bias. Let me give you another example. The other example is, and then I'll close with this. The other example is the following. It's that, you know, I love my wife. I love her very much. But we have often different political views. What happens is that if I believe ABC, she'll often believe CBA. Just the opposite. Well, there's an advantage. The advantage is that if it's a nice sunny day on election day, we don't have to vote. Because my vote will just cancel hers. Right? Well, it should. That's a Z2 symmetry. I'm taking this and I'm flipping it. It's a Z2 symmetry. And so the issue then is that the case? And the answer is no. The answer is not the case. Because if I give W1 points to my first place candidate, and I give W2 points to my second place candidate, that's what I will give. My wife will give W1, W2, and we end up with W1, 2W2, W1. The only procedure where I will have a tie is if 2W2 is equal to W1 or the board account. Any other procedure introduces a bias. It introduces a bias, one way or the other. And what happens then is, in this way, it turns out that it is now possible, and this is a result of about a year old now, year and a half old, it now is possible to characterize all possible voting paradoxes that can ever occur. To look at those voting paradoxes and to determine why they crop up. You can explain now why each of them crop up. You can create examples of each and every one of them using nothing harder than simple algebra now. And so essentially the old voting problem that's been around since Borda in the 1770s is essentially solved. But the problem remains open for statistics. The same type of problem carries over to probability and statistics. The only trouble is you're using different symmetry groups. And those aren't quite understood yet. And in fact, what happens is, if you we always look at the engineers as doing very good things and nothing going wrong, and I started talking with engineers and find out a lot of things go wrong all the time. One of the reasons things go wrong in engineering is because of their decision procedures. And their decision procedures encounter all of the same symmetry, chaos, and everything else that I'm trying to indicate to you today. So really, and that is an area which is very ripe. People are just starting to look at some of these issues. So really then in conclusion, you can start off with a very simple example that the people in political science or economics or something else believe is important, or an anomaly, or sociology or anywhere else. And then by taking that problem and posing it in mathematical terms, Arrow's theorem, or something else, posing it in mathematical terms, asking, as mathematicians do, what is the symmetry structure of the domain? What's the symmetry structure of the range? What is the domain? What's the range? What's the inverse image? Just the standard questions we teach starting in freshman calculus. Well, not symmetry structures, but unless you're further ahead than we are. But it's undergraduates, just the basic questions which are asked as undergraduates. It becomes possible to create a tremendous program which addresses the questions that the social scientists did not believe possible to be addressed. And not only that, but you get some very good mathematics out of there. For example, in working on there, really what I've defined for you turns out to be a special case of the wreath products or permutation groups. When I discovered that was a symmetry structure on Lee's voting, I knew I created a new type of a group. And one of my colleagues was one of the world's experts on it as he walked home with me, and so I learned differently. But as far as a result, if you want a result which will, according to the mathematics, a result which will reflect the views of the voters, you need to use the board account. All other methods introduce a bias. Now, I'm not saying that I always recommend the board account. When I was at Northwestern, they were saying, Don, you're giving these lectures on voting all over the world. Why don't you give one to us? Nah. Come on, Don, give us a lecture. Nah. Come on. All right. So I gave the lecture. That was long before I had some of these results I showed you. And they said, and the worst fear came true. The very next day, they changed our voting procedure to the board account. You see, I knew the voting procedure we had was giving us biased outcomes. But they were biased in the favor that I liked. And so what happened is that when they had a board account, unfortunately, outcomes were far more fair. Everyone recognized they were fair now, and I didn't like that. So with that confession, I thank you.